Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. It is open lines for your questions and your comments. Open means open. That means anything you want to talk about. Don't feel bad or guilty about changing the subject. I always have something I put on the table for discussion. That's merely to get things started. It's just the little spark that gets the fire going, and soon all those around can warm up and is glowing. That's how it is with open lines. Once you experience it, you talk and talk to everyone, and you want to pass it on. Or in the case of some people, they just want to turn it off. But I ask you not to do that. In a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from Douglas Johnson. I had opportunity to speak with him earlier today about this vote that is expected in the U.S. House tomorrow on two human cloning bills. They stand in opposition to one another. One is called Weldon Stupak, and it would ban all human cloning. Now, this is a House bill that was passed before, but of course the Senate kind of clogged it up and everything gets started all over again. And then there's also what's being called the Greenwood substitute that would, in the words of our president, allow embryo farms. The question here between these two bills is simply this. One will ban all human cloning. The other will not. One is a good bill. The other one is not. Douglas Johnson is legislative director of National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. I spoke to him earlier. Here's how it went. Douglas Johnson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Tell us about the Weldon Stupak bill that the House is considering today.
This is the bill that President Bush supports and that we support that would ban the cloning of human embryos in the United States. There are biotech firms and even universities that are working day and night to try to overcome technical obstacles so that they can start mass cloning embryos, human embryos, so that they can use them in biomedical research, and that research will kill these embryos. We believe that's a very bad idea. It's a bad line for our society to cross, and we support this legislation.
And what is this so-called Greenwood substitute that they're also going to be looking at this afternoon?
The House will vote first on the Greenwood substitute, which is a radically different approach to human cloning. The Greenwood substitute would say these firms, these biotech firms, can clone as many human embryos as they want, as long as they kill them in biomedical research. So this would be a green light to what President Bush called human embryo farms, where human embryos would be mass created using the cloning process, grown for a certain number of days, and then killed for their stem cells or for other biomedical research purposes. Literally, they'd be growing like crops, and that's why President Bush called them human embryo farms.
And what is your expectation? I know that National Right to Life has been working hard with the House members to try and show them the distinction between these two, clear up these misconceptions, but what do you expect the vote to be?
Well, it's hard to say. The House passed the good ban 2 years ago, and they rejected the phony ban, the Greenwood Amendment, but congressmen are under a lot of pressure from various interest groups and research facilities and biotech firms to support this so-called therapeutic cloning, which means the creation of the human embryos to kill them in research. And so some of the congressmen who voted correctly a couple of years ago are now wavering, and we hope they hear from people who agree with President Bush that human embryo farms are a bad idea, that human cloning of every type is a bad idea, and we'll communicate that by telephone before the vote occurs on Thursday afternoon.
If Weldon Stupak does pass, what are its prospects when it gets to the Senate?
We face a very tough fight in the Senate. So far, neither side has the votes necessary to pass either the good bill or the bad bill. But it's still a very fluid situation because I think a lot of the public really hasn't figured out yet what's going on or how imminent some of these things are if Congress does not act. The president has urged again and again the Congress to act before it's too late to pass the ban on cloning, human cloning, before these human embryo farms open for business. But we don't have enough senators yet to support that position. In the Senate, it's called the Brownback Bill. Now, it is fortunate that Senator Bond has been a leading advocate of banning human cloning. He was one of the first senators to take that position way back when Dolly the Sheep was first announced to the world. Senator Talent, we're hopeful, will decide to co-sponsor the ban, too. He hasn't done that yet. But we need to get not just 50 but 60 senators to get past a filibuster on the part of the pro-cloning forces, and we're not there yet.
Now, you mentioned the president's stand on this. He seems very strongly behind Weldon Stupak. What about his Council on Bioethics? Where does that seem to stand?
Well, the Council on Bioethics was very badly split on human cloning policy. There were some who supported the so-called therapeutic cloning, which is the cloning of embryos to kill them in research, and others opposed it. But they did at least agree on a few things. They agreed on what the argument is about, and that is so important. And so in their report, they were unanimous in saying this process of so-called somatic cell nuclear transfer is the technical term. When it's engaged in with human genetic material, it will produce human embryos, just like it's been done with sheep and cows and so forth. And it's a question then of what are we going to do with these human embryos who've been created. Some people say, let's just keep them, we'll develop them for a couple of weeks, and then we'll make sure they end up dead. And that's called, they call that therapeutic cloning, but it's not therapeutic for the embryos who would be created and harvested like crops. And the people who support that position say we'll pass a law, which is this Greenwood Amendment, that would say that no one can implant one of these embryos in a woman's womb. Well, you know, that's really a federal law that says they all have to die. And we think that would be a very bad law. It's much better to say let's not use cloning on human beings to begin with. Let's not create these human embryos through cloning to begin with. And that's what the Weldon Stupak bill, the Brownback bill, which President Bush supports, that's what it would do. It says no cloning. Cows, yes. Mice, yes. But no cloning of humans.
On a more local note here, I have seen a National Review column asking a question about our local representative, Dick Gephardt, and his position on cloning. He seems to have bounced around a bit. What's his position?
Well, that's a good question. You know, when this bill was up in the summer of 2001, he voted in favor of the Clone and Kill Bill, this Greenwood substitute to allow human embryo farms. He voted for that, but it was defeated. And then he had a second chance to vote for or against the real bill, the Weldon Stupak bill, and he voted against it. So he was for human cloning and cloning of human embryos for research. But just 3 weeks later, on Meet the Press, a nationally televised NBC show, he said, and I quote directly, "We passed a law saying no cloning, and I think that's the law we ought to follow," end of quote. So it appeared that he had changed his mind 3 weeks later, because he was basically taking credit for the House passing the bill that he had opposed. And he was saying, more importantly, he was saying, "I think that's the law that we ought to follow." Now, he can only have been talking about the Weldon Stupak bill. It's the only bill that the House passed dealing with human cloning. So we hope he sticks to this. I'm afraid he's going to try to wiggle out of it. But again, what he said before a national TV audience was, "We passed a law saying no cloning, and I think that's the law we ought to follow," end of quote. If that's the law we ought to follow, we hope he'll vote for it on Thursday in the House of Representatives.
Douglas, what can our listeners do in the next 24 hours before the vote actually comes down in the House of Representatives?
Well, it's really too late at this point for anything but telephone calls, because mail may not get read in time, even email. So I would encourage listeners to call the offices of whichever congressman represents them. If they're not sure who that is, because district lines have changed and so forth, they can go to our website, and there's a zip code finder there that will take them directly to a page that describes their congressman's record and suggests a message that might be sent. Our website is www.nrlc.org. That's NRLC for National Right to Life Committee.org. And it's right there up front where everybody can find it easily.
Do you have the number for the main switchboard of the offices there, where if people do want to make that phone call?
Yes, the call to any congressman's Washington office is at 202-225-3121. That's 202-225-3121. However, during periods of controversial legislation, sometimes that switchboard is just overwhelmed and people can't get an answer. So I often encourage people to call the local district office of their congressman. For example, Congressman Gephardt in St. Louis has an office at 894-3400. That's 894-3400. To call that office and say, please, Congressman, I'd like it to be recorded. I am a constituent of Congressman Giffard, and I want him to vote against the Greenwood Amendment, against human embryo farms. I want him to do what he said on Meet the Press in the summer of 2001. That would be much more likely to be registered, perhaps, than trying to get through that crowded Capitol switchboard with a long-distance call.
Douglas Johnson, keep up the good work, and we're hoping for the best tomorrow. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Now, that's a conversation we had with Douglas Johnson earlier today from National Right to Life, talking about that vote expected in the U.S. House tomorrow on these two cloning bills, the first one, Weldon Stupak, and the second one called the Greenwood Substitute. One would ban all human cloning. This is the one I'm praying for. I am hoping that my representative votes for. And the other one, the Greenwood Substitute, is actually kind of a cloning kill bill. Well, it's not kind of a cloning kill bill. It is a cloning kill bill. It would, in the words of President George W. Bush, allow human embryo farms. And if that sounds Orwellian enough for you, even Orwell didn't imagine this. Now, I asked the question in the course of that conversation with Douglas Johnson about Representative Richard Gephardt, who, if you were watching the Sunday news shows, seems to be bouncing around in his position on the cloning bill. Here is the actual column I referred to in that conversation with Douglas Johnson from National Review. You can read it for yourself at nationalreview.com. It's all one word, nationalreview.com. Does Gephardt have a clone? The presidential contender ought to review his cloning videotape. Which way will Dick Gephardt come down on human cloning when the House takes it up this week? It might depend on the way the wind is blowing. A recent entrant in the Democratic presidential candidate ring, Missouri Democrat Dick Gephardt, has a history of having it both ways when it comes to cloning. On Thursday, the House of Representatives will debate two cloning bills, one half-baked, the other comprehensive. Perhaps Gephardt might want to consider some of his past statements on the issue before he votes. On NBC's Meet the Press back in August of 2001, 3 weeks after the House voted and passed Weldon Stupak the first time, which bans all human cloning, in the process of answering a question on embryonic stem cell research, Richard Gephardt told host Tim Russert, obviously, we don't want cloning. Nobody is for cloning, end quote. And as if to confirm that viewers hadn't misheard, without prompting, Gephardt emphasized about a minute later, quote, we passed a law that says no cloning, and I think that's the law we ought to follow, end quote. His use of the term we is curious, writes this columnist, considering that Gephardt did not vote for the ban. Instead, he voted against Weldon Stupak. Instead of voting for the real cloning ban, Gephardt voted for a substitute offered by Pennsylvanian Republican Jim Greenwood that would have effectively gutted the House ban, allowing for so-called research and therapeutic cloning. The Greenwood Amendment, which will also be taken up again tomorrow, is similar to a bogus ban currently sponsored by Utah Republican Orrin Hatch and California Democrat Dianne Feinstein in the Senate. Let's get this straight, though. Even though Gephardt voted against it, Gephardt endorsed Weldon Stupak, its comprehensive ban against all human cloning, legitimate cloning ban on national television. He should be reminded of this early and often. And the column concludes, if Gephardt includes himself among those who don't want cloning, as he suggested to Tim Russert, he should go ahead and lead the voting for Weldon Stupak this week. If for no other reason, it'll be a step forward distinguishing him from the other dwarves in the primary race. That's from National Review Online. The title of that article, by the way, if you want to read it for yourself, Does Gephardt Have a Clone? Maybe you saw Jonah Goldberg's op-ed piece, his column, under abortion rights, How Close is the Court to Overturning Roe v. Wade? In here is a question for you. It appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. In here is a question. Do you think that Roe v. Wade will ever be overturned in your lifetime? Or ever, I guess, for that matter. Here's the column. In an editorial headlined, The War Against Women, the New York Times recently declared, quote, as the 30th anniversary of Roe decision approaches, a woman's right to safe legal abortions is in dire peril. Kate Michelman, the head of NARAL Pro-Choice America, said to USA Today, a woman's right to choose is probably in the greatest danger since Roe v. Wade was handed down. Michelman says that a slim one-vote margin on the Supreme Court protects the freedom of choice, and a single appointment by George W. Bush could repeal that freedom. However, writes Goldberg, Jeffrey Rosen, a professor at George Washington University and the legal affairs editor of the New Republic, thinks this is hogwash. Remember we talked about this, folks, about the tendency of the pro-abortion forces to constantly say the sky is falling and that Roe is about to be overturned? Well, apparently, Rosen, who favors abortion rights himself, notes that the Supreme Court is pro-choice by a two-vote margin, not one. And it's almost inconceivable that two pro-choice justices will retire and be replaced by two pro-life justices anytime soon. According to Michelman, Justice Anthony Kennedy is anti-Roe because he voted for a ban on partial birth abortions in 2000. But this overlooks the fact that Kennedy has always argued that Roe permits states to regulate late-term abortions. And on one more than one occasion, Kennedy has reaffirmed his support for Roe. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that makes him pro-choice. But abortion rights advocates have a financial and political interest in making Roe seem more imperiled than it is. And these extremists are unwilling to concede what is really readily apparent to most Americans, quote, there is a big difference between aborting a pregnancy at 2 weeks and aborting one at 8 months. Now, I'll take issue here with Jonah Goldberg. There is no difference morally between the two. Although the yuck factor, I guess you could say, there's a big difference. In a recent CNN Gallup USA Today poll, these facts are confirmed. 2/3 of Americans believe abortion should be legal in the first trimester. In the second trimester, that plummets to 1/4 of Americans, and in the last trimester, when partial birth abortions take place, only 1 in 10 Americans favor keeping abortion legal. Although I would inject at this point, that is still disturbing that 10% of Americans think that partial birth abortion in the third trimester should be legal. Rosen believes that America would be better off if Roe v. Wade were overturned, partly because the decision is bad constitutional law, but also because such an action would expose the fundamental weakness of the extreme anti-abortion position. Now, Rosen is pro-abortion, but he thinks Roe v. Wade should be overturned, and that everyone would be better off if it were, because it's bad law. And he says that the Republican Party would be severely damaged if Roe were overturned. Here's his reasoning. Right now, Republicans benefit from the fact that a majority of Americans may be pro-choice, but the majority of people who vote specifically on the issue of abortion are pro-life. So Republicans can say that they are pro-life without having to do anything about it. If Roe were overturned, reasons Rosen, and abortion became a legislative issue rather than a judicial issue, Rosen predicts that many pro-choice Republicans would desert the party in droves while Democrats would cut loose their pro-choice extremists. He also argues that very few states would pass abortion bans very different from what most Americans feel. Few restrictions for early abortions, quite a few for late ones. Goldberg concludes, looking so far ahead may be shaky. Science continues to change the equation on both sides. Birth control will presumably become more reliable, and at the same time, biology is making life begins at conception argument more plausible for many people. After all, the first baby pictures most of us see these days are taken in utero. Also, there's politics. Many of us have argued that Roe was a bad decision because it short-circuited the Democratic decision-making process. Who is to say that if Roe were overturned, Republicans wouldn't try to offer a compromise position rooted in allowing the states to experiment with solutions? Also, who is to say that pro-choice extremists wouldn't wield more clout in the Democratic Party than Rosen anticipates? But Rosen is surely right about one thing, says Goldberg. The country would surely be better off if Roe were overturned sooner rather than later. Do you think it ever will be? That's the question for you. I want your answer to that question. Do you think that Roe v. Wade will really ever be overturned? Do you think it will be overturned in your lifetime? The phone numbers are 505-7850, or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I have wondered about this. I am the skeptic. I am, in some cases, the cynic, who believes that Roe v. Wade perhaps might be here to stay in some form or another. Although history seems to paint a different picture, you got to take the long view, but think about it. Let's draw the parallel with civil rights, if we could. In 1776, we had the Declaration of Independence that said, in an unqualified way, that all men are created equal, endowed with their Creator by certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet, in that America of 1776, slavery was the norm. It was not universally approved of. But even the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence never freed his many, many slaves. He kept them until the day he died, and they were left to his heirs. Slavery persisted until, the 13th Amendment, 1865, almost 100 years in this nation, as a nation. Now, I'd like to draw the connection between abortion and the civil rights movement. If we start all the way back at 1776 and take that long view, we might be in for Roe for a long, long time before the nation wises up as a nation and decides that it was bad law and it is bad, period. We would all like to see it happen in our lifetimes. Do you think it ever will? Or do you think we'll have to, like the issue of slavery, have to wait 100 years before it is abolished and then, another 50 or more before the lingering social effects of slavery are dealt with by our courts or by our laws? What do you think? Will Jesus return before Roe? Will Roe v. Wade be on the books when Jesus returns? What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming up on a break, but before we go, the other big news on this front, of course, you've heard, is the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that a lower court's federal ruling was wrong in punishing a national network of anti-abortion protesters under the RICO statute, that is, the Racketeering Influenced and Corruption Act, Organizations Act, RICO. Usually, it was crafted in the Kennedy administration to deal with organized crime, but there was an attempt made to apply it to abortion protesters. And today, the Supreme Court said that law was wrongly applied in punishing the abortion protesters. Now, this sounds like good news on the surface of it, but if you dig a little deeper, you might discover in the decision that the court didn't say that what the abortion protesters did was illegal. They just said that the RICO statute couldn't be used in order to indict them. It's open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I receive, review, and read a lot of books in preparation for the broadcast hours of Issues Etc. Sad to say, some of what Christian Publishing produces isn't worth reading, but some is. That's why we have the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can also order the book online. Go to our Issues Etc. website at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. The book, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. 1-800-325-3040.
Creation, is it a secondary doctrine?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, I've heard some Christian leaders claim that creation is just a secondary doctrine and that it's not important to the Christian message. What do you say to that?
Actually, I've heard these claims for years from Christians who react negatively to my insistence that we must believe in literal Genesis, that God created in six literal days, just thousands of years ago. Just recently, I had a letter from the head of a large Christian organization in America. It claimed that creation was a secondary doctrine like the rapture, and it shouldn't be the cause of division in the church. But think about this. What doctrine is the rapture foundational to? Well, none to my knowledge. Yet the creation account in Genesis 1-11 is foundational to every single biblical doctrine of theology. If you don't accept a literal Genesis, then you've no foundation for sin, marriage, clothing, the gospel. In fact, ultimately all doctrines are dependent on Genesis being literal history. No, creation isn't a secondary doctrine. It's foundational to our faith. This is one instance where we do need to divide over a vital issue.
Our popular and attractive website, AnswersRadio.com, provides you with answers to many tough questions. Whether it's dinosaurs, Cain's wife, or carbon dating, we provide answers free on our website, AnswersRadio.com. You can read the answers right on your computer screen or download them and print them out. Go to AnswersRadio.com.
Good afternoon, 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, cloudy tonight, low of about 20. It's going to be cold. And for tomorrow, cloudy with occasional snow. 2 to 5 inches of accumulation is expected, high near 32. Right now, overcast and 27 in St. Louis. Our last look at St. Louis traffic, westbound 40 after Hampton, slow traffic to Hanley. Westbound 70 between Kings Highway and Jennings Station Road, slow traffic there. Southbound 270 between Manchester and Doherty Ferry, there's some slow traffic there. Northbound 270 after Dorset Road, slow traffic just in the westbound 70 exit lane. Eastbound 40 at Jefferson, stop-and-go traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge. And northbound 55 at the Poplar Street Bridge, there's a disabled vehicle and traffic is backed up to 44. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Craig Allen.
AM 850 KFUO will have a special program Thursday afternoon. The Southern Illinois District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod will begin its convention with a worship service that will be broadcast live beginning at 5:30. The Reverend Gerald Kieschnick, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will provide the sermon. Again, that's 5:30 Thursday afternoon here on AM 850 KFUO, the live worship service from the Southern Illinois District Convention.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll have Dr. Doug Grodheis of Denver Seminary answering this question. Was Jesus a great thinker? I'll tell you what I think up front. Yes. We'll find out what he has to say tomorrow on Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. During open lines, it's always anything you want to talk about, but I have asked the question and I would like your answer. Do you think that Roe v. Wade will be overturned in your lifetime? There are a few, in the news lately, there are a few things that would chip away at it, at least state regulation of abortion. And people have noted that popular opinion, public opinion, seems to have shifted somewhat in the last decade or so. Do you think it will really ever be overturned? People talk about it all the time. It's spoken of as though it were the holy grail of the pro-life movement. Although, if you check with the pro-lifers, you will find those who I think are doing more harm than good in working toward getting it overturned. They're insisting a total overturning of Roe v. Wade, period, and any incremental approach is nonsense, is useless. I completely disagree. Nothing happens overnight. If we take our, let's take our lesson again from slavery and the civil rights movement, from Dred Scott to the abolition of slavery, was what, about less than 10 years, okay? But remember, Dred Scott came before the abolition of slavery, darkest before the dawn, they say. But look at what transpired between then and 1968. 100 years, where even after slavery, this nation was still sorting out the place of the black man and woman in our midst. And some would argue we still are. And if people wouldn't have taken the incremental approach, we might not have ever had slavery abolished. So I'm all in favor of the incremental approach, if it's the only approach that you have, which I think in our case it is. What do you think? Do you think Roe v. Wade will ever be overturned? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And since every little bit helps, on that cloning bill, which is related, we're not talking science fiction here. We're talking about science fact, where people are actually trying to achieve human cloning, and they're seeking legislative approval by saying, let's either ban it or not ban it. Right now, the U.S. House of Representatives are talking about two opposing bills, one that would ban all human cloning, period, the other that would allow so-called therapeutic cloning, the clone and kill bill, that would make it illegal for anyone to allow a cloned human embryo to live. You can clone them all you want, you just can't let them live. And if you would like to toss in your two cents with your representative, good luck in getting through. But the main switchboard number for the U.S. House of Representatives, I'll give it out, 202-225-3121. That's area code 202-225-3121. Ask for your particular representative. And if your representative happens to be Representative Dick Gephardt, who has said yes and no, and who voted against the ban and then said he was for the ban, you can call and get through to his St. Louis office. Area code 314-894-3400. And if you're trying to call that Washington number to get through to your particular representative, that area code 202-225-3121, my producer informs me he just tried and he got through. And you could tell them to vote for Weldon Stupak and against the Greenwood Amendment. Have any of you called Congressman Gephardt on this? I know there are people who do it on a regular basis. I want to hear from those of you who call Congressman Gephardt tomorrow on issues, etc. By the way, if you call tomorrow, it'll be too late. They're going to vote tomorrow. So you got to call today. If you call today or tonight, leave a message, whatever you do. I want to hear from you tomorrow. And I want to hear from you right now. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Do you think Roe v. Wade will ever be overturned? Now, the reason I ask this question is this, and I'll go on to some other things. The reason I ask this question is this. There are two positions that I think are kind of the fatalist positions. It will never be overturned, therefore there's not really much we can do about it. It's here to stay, and any attempts to try and overturn it are futile, therefore we kind of have to live with the status quo. The best we can ever hope for is to simply chip away little bit by little bit, but never get to the heart of Roe's logic or what it's wrought in this country, decriminalized abortion. The other end is the pie-in-the-sky view that says Roe v. Wade will be overturned. Maybe it will take a miracle, but it will be overturned. And anything short of overturning Roe v. Wade shouldn't be attempted. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. According to the 2003 Yearbook of American and Canadian Churches, just out, and this is according to Religion News Service, Roman Catholics, Mormons, Pentecostals, and a black denomination called AME Zion are the fastest growing churches in the United States. The annual report of church membership figures compiled by the National Council of Churches found more than 159 million adherents to some 216 different denominations in 2001, the latest figures that are available. The fastest growing church, according to self-reported numbers, now this comes with a grain of salt, I'll explain that in a second, is the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. Wasn't that the church that President Bill Clinton attended in Washington, D.C. when he did attend church? I think he went to an AME Episcopal Zion church up there, if I'm not mistaken. They report 11.67% growth. Roman Catholics reported 2.49% growth. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, 1.9% growth. And the Assemblies of God, 1.92% growth. Roman Catholics continue to top the membership charts. 65 million Americans estimated. And you may have heard earlier on Issues Etc. last week before last, internationally, the Roman Catholic Church has topped a billion. And only 65 million Roman Catholics out of a billion are in the United States. I want you to think of that in terms of percentages. A billion is 1,000 million. Only 65 out of 1,000 million Roman Catholics are in the United States. The overwhelming, vast, multitudinous majority of Christians exist outside the borders of America. Of the two of the largest 25 churches, largest churches are Greek and Greek Orthodox Church and the Orthodox Church in America. The rest are either Protestant or Mormon. Total church giving for 2001 was reported at $31 billion for the 63 denominations that submit figures for the yearbook. Now we're talking about North American, Canadian, and American churches, not worldwide. The take worldwide, I'm sure, is much bigger than $31 billion. One thing that's missing from this is, and of course those who do the research admit this readily, is the megachurch factor, those non-denominational megachurches that don't get counted because they don't report to denominations. And I think that probably complicating that is that megachurches generally don't tend to count members. They tend to be far more concerned with attendance numbers than they are with membership numbers. Those who have compiled the data say that the megachurch factor is largely invisible in their counting. Here's how it breaks down. The Roman Catholic Church has 65.2 million members in Canada and America. The Southern Baptist Convention, a very distant second at 16 million, but 16 million is nothing to sneeze at. The United Methodist Church, about half that, 8.3 million. And then there's a whole bunch of fives in here. All around 5 million, the Church of God in Christ, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the National Baptist Convention USA, and then trailing, we've got the National Baptist Convention of America. What's the difference between that and USA? I don't know. Except that one has 5 million and the other one has 3.5 million. And then you've got the Presbyterian Church USA at 3.5 and the Assemblies of God at 2.6. Not making the cut, by the way, is my own Lutheran church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, hovering at 2.5 million. But not to worry, truth is not often in the majority. Now, I should say, just for the sake of clearing up something I said just a second ago, whenever I talk about non-denominational churches, you should hear in your head little quotation marks around that word non-denominational. Let's try it. I'm going to say non-denominational. You see the quotation marks. Non-denominational. Because it becomes tiresome to say quote-unquote non-denominational. There is no such thing as a non-denominational church. Not in reality. If you define them as being connected to a larger organization, a larger church body, yes, you could call them non-denominational. But what is usually meant by way of theology when someone says non-denominational is, we don't have any of that denominational, here are the quotation marks, theology in our church. We are not so concerned about doctrines. We're far more concerned about just everybody loves Jesus, everybody has faith in Jesus, and that's our common thing. But make no mistake about it. I think our friend Pastor Tom Baker is very well spoken when he says, if you say non-denominational, generally speaking, I can tell you what the church teaches. They don't baptize babies. They think that the Lord's Supper is a symbol. They will generally hold to a view that you have to make some sort of decision for Christ in order to be saved. Jesus plus your decision equals salvation. Among other things, they will call themselves Bible-believing. but they will skip over major portions of the Bible, like those dealing with baptism, Lord's Supper, things like that. And these things they have in common. Now, that doesn't make them officially a denomination or a church body, but if you're making a theological statement when you say non-denominational, they all pretty much end up looking the same. In fact, one might argue that non-denominational churches, on the whole, look more homogeneous theologically than do many denominations. Theologically. There's more theological diversity, sad to say, in many denominations than there is among non-denominational churches. One might even say cookie cutter. Let's go to the phones. Dennis is calling from Blackjack. Dennis, thank you for waiting and welcome to Issues
Insider. Hi, Todd. How are you doing?
Doing well.
I guess a follow-up to what you're saying, then they are non-doctrinal doctrine churches, I suppose. So.
Everybody's got doctrine. It's just that everyone is a theologian. Everyone has doctrine. You either express it or you don't. It's either scriptural or it isn't, period.
I do have a question, and I certainly don't have the answer to this question that I'm going to ask. If in the event that Roe versus Wade gets tossed aside, then do we criminalize people that perform abortions and that have abortions? Or do they become criminals then? Are there going to be criminal penalties for people that do that?
Are you asking for my opinion? Or are you asking?
I'm just asking generically. I don't know. Have people thought through the process? If it gets tossed aside, then is there going to legislation be put forth that criminalizes abortion then?
No, I think what is going to happen, if you want my realistic prognostication, it is that Roe v. Wade will be overturned in such a way so as to toss the whole issue back to the states. And there will be states where it will be decriminalized, okay, as it is. There will be states where, in other words, the question will no longer be a federal question. It will be a state's question. And there will be states where...
So they'll toss it back to the state.
Yes. I think that it's the only realistic way of doing it. Now, there will, I would say, if it happens, and I don't know if it will, if it happens, there will be states that will recriminalize abortion. And if you're asking for my personal opinion, I think if it is something that I think shouldn't be legal, it is only logical to say that those who perform them and have them would be partaking in criminal acts, just as much as a woman who hires someone to strangle her own child out of the womb would be performing a criminal act, and the person who strangled that child would be performing a criminal act. Yes, these would be criminal acts, and I think if the world were as it ought to be, they would be punishable by law.
Okay. Then historically, we would swing back to where we were prior to Roe versus Wade, where it was a criminal.
No, I think historically, before Roe v. Wade, it was a state's issue. And okay, some states were debating whether or not it ought to be criminal or not. I don't know which states had legalized abortion and which ones didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But what Roe did was make it a federal issue. It said nationally, as a matter of federal law, constitutional interpretation from the Supreme Court, it is decriminalized. And I like to use the term decriminalized rather than legalized, because legalized sounds like it's something that was kind of sitting on the shelf that was neutral, and we decided, well, you know, let's make it legal because it's a good thing anyway. Decriminalized, I think, says is more accurately what happened. It was, by and large, considered to be a criminal act to have or to perform an abortion before. Afterwards, with one fell swoop and stroke of the pen by the Roe Court, it was decriminalized. All right, Dennis?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You see the degree to which Dennis is not an example of this, but I'm thinking of the person out there who just heard me say that if we do live in a post-Roe world, that abortion ought to be punishable by law, criminal penalties of those who have them and those who perform them, and people will cringe and they'll say, you know, I'm with Wilkin on this thing, but I don't know if we should be. Make it a crime. Do you see the degree to which we've lost our nerve after 30 years? We'll say we're against it. We say it shouldn't be legal. But if asked the question, should it be a crime? Well, I don't know. Yes, it should be a crime. It is. It is a crime. It is murder. And if we would want any murder to come under the pale of our law and to be answered in a just way, we would include abortion in that as well. Now, someone's going to say, are we going to go back to back alley abortions and the coat hanger scenario? Well, I don't know how much that existed actually before Roe v. Wade. There has been research, although I can't put my fingers on it right at this second. There has been research into what the situation was before Roe and how many back alley abortions were really being performed. They were certainly being performed in states where it might have been illegal. But you know what's going to happen. States like Illinois will keep it legal with as little access as they possibly can. And states like Missouri might make it a crime. And what's going to happen is the people will go to Illinois to do it. Which raises the question of whether or not overturning Roe would actually make much of a difference. Except for those who don't have cars or something like that. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You know, even before Roe v. Wade was passed, doing an abortion with a coat hanger was illegal. And doing it in the back alley without a license was illegal. Those things were illegal before. So if you say we're going to go back to those things, I think not. They were illegal. As far as I know, it still is, isn't it? If someone just wants to run an abortion mill out of their back alley, the storefront or whatever, they can't do that legally, can they? Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, etc.
Yes, thank you. And I was interested in your rendering of those church membership statistics. Just to be brief, I think in some of the studies I've made with the 30 years of Lacusa statistics and other things, I would say that Lutherans in North America face three serious problems in their future. One is sticking with the integrity of their convictions. Two, they're in a culture that is antagonistic to them in theology. And three, they've got internal demographic problems that could be serious, particularly fewer children. Some of those other churches, like the Roman Catholics and Mormons, have emphasized large families, and even those statistics of growing like 2-something% close to that means at least that they're retaining people and they're having children.
Those are I think those are good observations. I'll comment, Herman. Thank you very much. I always appreciate Herman's calls. Cogent, well thought out, germane. He lists three things that the challenges. I think let's expand it beyond just Lutheranism in America. Let's say all those who are endeavoring to remain in the stream of the Reformation and not digging their little side canals like so many mainline. It's funny, we call them the mainline Protestant denominations, but in terms of theology, they're no longer mainline. Not in the history of the church. They're anything but mainline, the mainline Protestant denominations. They have deviated so far from the line, they're, I don't even know what you'd call them. What is the opposite of mainline? Whatever it is, that's them, theologically. Although with the numbers, it's true, they are still mainline Protestant denominations. Although you will note here that in the largest church bodies, this list of the 10 largest, the Episcopal Church USA does not appear any longer. Why? It has become so quote-unquote mainline and so far off the mainline theologically with Scripture that they're suffering for it. All right. So what are those who are trying to stay in the main channel of the stream of the Reformation facing? He's right. I would sharpen some of the things he said. He says that we need to regain the integrity or maintain the integrity of our convictions. Yes, we need to maintain the integrity of our convictions, but what we lack in particular, especially today, and I, as I'm pointing the finger around, remember all the fingers, all the rest of the fingers are pointing back at me, we lack the courage of our convictions. We've got convictions, but most of the time we keep them on paper, somewhere in the back office. Well, those are our convictions. We've got those pretty well set, but we've decided we've got better things to do. There's nothing better the church could do than to have the courage of its convictions. If we have convictions but lack the courage of them, what good are those convictions? To speak an offensive word of the gospel that offends, that people stumble over in the world? If we've got the gospel but we censor ourselves when we go into the public arena and soften it down and water it down and mix it in with other things or put it in metaphor and simile and poetic language so there's not to be heard as the offense that it is, what good is that gospel? What good is that gospel? If the gospel's got to be watered down in order for us to be willing to speak it in a hostile culture, then what good are we? I know what Jesus says. Salt that's lost its flavor is good for nothing, save to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. Yes, we live in an antagonistic culture, but this is nothing new. Let's just get used to it. We exist in an antagonistic culture as Christians. Our moral views are the least offensive things that we carry into this antagonistic culture. We think that our moral views against abortion and stuff like that are the things that offend people the most. Untrue. What stands at the heart of the Christian offense in the world is the cross of Jesus Christ. If we are being bad-mouthed because of our moral views, big deal. Big deal. Jesus says that if we are going to be spoken against, it's because of him. Now, if he's not up front, if he's not the reason we're being spoken against, big deal. And then, of course, I think Herman is quite correct. The Orthodox Christianity, theologically Orthodox Christianity, does suffer from demographic problems. And we are having fewer children, that's true. We're not even nationally at the replacement level, and Mormons are having more children, Roman Catholics are having more children. Islam is growing because of its prodigious reproduction. But I would say, to balance that out, Christianity has never enjoyed the majority, even when it thought it did. Even when in pockets and places of culture and geography, where Western Europe in 16 centuries, things like this, where people said Christianity was in the majority, it never has been in reality. Especially if you take a global view of it, breathing down the neck of 16th century Christian Europe was the vast hordes of Islam. Right? And the world yet undiscovered at the time was full of people who were still worshiping trees and eagles and horses. Never been in the majority. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc. I'll be back tomorrow.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.